Maysam Hosseini is 14 years old. He lives in Belgium, and he speaks Dari. That's one of the languages of Afghanistan. It's the only language he speaks, or it was. Maysam is a refugee kid, one of millions who are trying to figure out a new life in a new world. And his story, it throws up all kinds of big questions, questions about cultural difference, assimilation, and language. In Maysam's case, it's a particular kind of language acquisition that's only recently started to be researched. So in today's pod, Maysam's story.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Maysam and his family arrived in Belgium last year after making one of those insanely arduous journeys across continents. My colleague here in the World's Newsroom, Jeb Sharp, she's been tracking the progress of the family as they adapt to a new life in Western Europe, a completely new life compared to how they lived back in Afghanistan.
They were shepherds, basically, small farmers with a flock of 39 sheep and a few donkeys.
Why did they leave?
The Taliban. As they tell it, life had become increasingly miserable and dangerous for them under the Taliban. So this is the boy, Maysam, describing an encounter with two Taliban fighters while he was out grazing the sheep. And they started badgering him and asking him what he was doing and where he lived. They threatened him. They said they wanted him to place something in a police car for them, presumably a bomb. He said he would talk to his parents, and they said, okay, we'll see you back here in the morning. But when he went home and told his parents, they told him not to go back. And that incident turned out to be the last straw for the family. The boy's father had been attacked a few years before. A cousin had been killed by the Taliban. And they tried to find another safe place to graze the sheep. But after 10 days, they decided to sell up and flee, like so many others before them.
And so the family ended up in Belgium, in Brussels. And at the center of this is the young teenager, Maysam. Part of him grown up, part still a child.
Before he arrived in Brussels, he'd never been to school a day in his life. And I wanted to know how someone like him would catch up, would learn to speak and read and write a language he'd never spoken before in a new school in a new land. The challenges, obviously, are enormous, and all of it is possible, but made so much easier if there's some sort of intervention, someone who realizes the kind of special attention a kid like this will need. And happily, in this case, Maysam and his family landed on the doorstep of a wonderful host family in Brussels. This is the other part of this story, people opening their homes to complete strangers.
It just seemed to me like the odds were so stacked against these people arriving here. I mean, they've been through unbearable experiences in their home countries, and they've made such sacrifices to come here, and it seemed like really the least we could do to help a little bit once they get here.
This is Catherine McSweeney. She's Irish. Her husband, Thomas Van Houten, is Belgian, and they have two young children, a boy and a girl. And Catherine is just especially suited to battling the bureaucracies who are staring down these refugees. She's in international development and has worked for the UN, the World Bank, and she has this can-do spirit. And you can see that in the way she's thrown herself into helping this one family from Afghanistan.
I think if we all just do a little bit, then Europe will be a nicer place for our children. I don't really want ghettos of frustrated migrants who feel excluded culturally and economically. I don't want my children to grow up in that kind of country. So it's really in my self-interest to help those people and help them stand on their own two feet, find jobs, learn the language, and be fellow citizens who can participate fully.
So Catherine and her husband did their bit and took in Maysam and his parents.
They actually slept for 5 days. I mean, for almost 5 days, every time I would come downstairs, they were fast asleep. I think they were so exhausted. And any time they woke up, it was just to eat and to be cared for medically, because they were also very sick. They each had lung infections.
When they did emerge from their slumber, this is a family of three, 13-year-old Maysam, his mother Aziza, and father Noraga. Catherine and Thomas learned something about them they hadn't understood before.
Whenever I tried to talk to them, the father would say, "Maysam speaks English, Maysam speaks English." And we quickly realized Maysam doesn't really speak English. He picked up some words along the way, apparently in Iran, I think. I also remember trying to show Noor Aga my phone number and him not being able to read the numbers. But then I tried to show him on his phone and I wrote down the numbers as they were on his phone and I realized he couldn't read that either. So then I realized that he was probably illiterate and I saw their documents and the signature wasn't really a signature. And then I think it's when Thomas started to try to teach English to Maysam that we realized he hadn't held a pen before or, you know, sat with paper and tried to learn before. So, yeah, so I think we realized that they were from a very rural background. Yeah, that's the family that we had.
Okay, so here's this family in Europe. They want to do right by this other family that have come from thousands of miles away, but they're only just beginning to realize what a challenge this is. I mean, they've got a kid who can't read or write, whose life experiences are sheep herding and getting chased by the Taliban and then making this unbelievably epic journey across two continents. But at the same time, he's never been to school.
Yeah. And neither have his parents. It's really kind of extraordinary. And what happens next is, you know, families take these refugees in, but just for a very short time so that they are taken care of until they have their first appointments with the system, as it were. So they helped the family navigate these initial immigration appointments. The family entered the country when things were pretty chaotic. So this is end of 2015. And there were actually kind of unruly crowds outside the asylum office every day. And things had sort of ground to a halt, or at the very least degenerated into this very dysfunctional system. But the family did eventually get their initial appointment and interview, and they were assigned to what's called a reception center, which is basically a refugee shelter, while they waited for the outcome of their asylum application. And that center was on the outskirts of Brussels. So the family moved there. You have to, once you're assigned and in the system. And Catherine and her husband, Thomas, and their kids took it upon themselves to visit on the weekends. And I got to tag along on one of those visits.
Yeah. Two little bundles of energy. What are we going to do with you?
I'm just going to run you around to the center because I often go by myself. And then controlling these two while having a conversation with the family is really difficult. But my son is very good with them. He sort of keeps them under control. Is it open?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you sit in the front.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, the car is a bit.
Oh, please. Yeah, please, don't really worry. No apologies. Where are we actually going?
We're going to
south, northeast, west.
To a center in the north. It's called a village called Nederoverheembeek.
Thomas goes on to explain the refugee shelter is basically a converted warehouse and they've divided it up into little cubicles to try to give families some privacy, and there's almost nothing to do there. Thomas is great. He's kind of a corporate guy. He directs strategy in the Brussels office of Solvay, which is a big global chemicals company. So, you know, maybe not your cartoon image of the do-gooder, volunteer, help the refugees guy, but he, like Catherine, has become really attached to the Afghan family, and especially wanting to help Maysam learn one of Belgium's main languages.
I couldn't care less whether it's French or Dutch, as long as he, I mean, the most important thing is that he learns a language, you know, one of the national languages in Belgium, so that he has all chances to do something fruitful with his life, if he stays here indeed. So
that sentiment pretty much guides everything this Brussels family does for their new Afghan friends. They want them to succeed if they stay, and if they're forced to go back, they want them to at least go with the best possible feelings for Belgium and its people. Which is why they were appalled by the stories Maysem told them after he was placed in a local French-speaking school near the refugee center. There were no services for the refugee children, and the teacher simply carried on in French while the handful of kids in the back of the class tried to follow without any extra help.
I think it's going to take him a long time to catch up that way. He would have to be very, very bright to catch up. And, you know, we just feel that Maysem is 13. He has quite a small window of opportunity to catch up. And if he doesn't, he could be 16, 17, you know, not passing his exams. And then what does he have? You know, he'll be a kind of teen dropout, and he'll just have to fall back on whatever odd jobs he can find. So that's why we contacted other schools. We had an idea that
it took a while and many infuriatingly Belgian bureaucratic hurdles, but Catherine finally found a much better school for Maysem. This one is in a Dutch-speaking town called Mechelen. The school is about 80% immigrant kids, and it has special catch-up classes for new arrivals like Maysem. And the only catch was that it was a longish journey by bus and by train. At that time, it was an hour and a half for him to get to school. And so imagine you don't read or write Dutch, French, English, whatever. So what if the platform changes or the bus doesn't show up? So Catherine and Thomas, of course, anticipated all of this, and they did a dry run with him and sort of role-played so he could get himself out of trouble if he needed to.
We would say, okay, Maysem, you know, go up to the ticket guy and just say, you know, can I have 4 tickets to Mechelen, please? And he's not afraid to do that. He did it really, really well, and he seemed to kind of enjoy it. And the same with asking for directions. We said, okay, just walk up to that person and say, you know, is this the bus to the school? And he did that. So I think he's quite an independent guy. And
there is a center. Okay. So you see, it's like a big hangar. Yeah.
Catherine calls the interpreter who's meeting us to help us talk to the Afghan family.
Hello, Omid. We are here now.
So they won't
the
like your
recording
ask, equipment in there,
not...
so I would not show it. I would invite the family out, take them for a walk.
Okay.
We're not allowed to go inside the center, so the kids play outside while we wait for Maysem and his parents to appear. And when they do, I get to see just how much affection has already developed between the two families.
Everybody
without
the car seat.
There
they are.
Hi. Raga, how are you?
Rafa.
It's a very sweet scene. The kids are thrilled to see Maysem. At 13, he's as tall as a man, but with this soft, round face of a boy. Polite, smiling, dressed in sneakers and sweatpants. His parents' faces are far more worn, of course, but they're both beaming. And his mother's bright green scarf lends this welcome splash of color to a gray day and the industrial backdrop.
This is our friend, Jeff. And she's from America.
There's nowhere for us to hang out at the refugee center, so we head up the road a little way to a cafe at a farm where we can get hot drinks and pastries and talk.
Heard a lot about you.
Aziza.
Aziza.
We introduce ourselves again. They pronounce their family name for me, Hosaini. And over the next hour or so, with Ahmed's help, I piece together the basics of their story.
Where to start? Why are you here? Why are you here?
Because of the problems.
Problems as the war?
مشکل از جنگ
مشکلی که ما در منطقه‌ای که ما میشینیم
Naraga explains that the family are Shiite and targeted by the Sunni Taliban. They couldn't venture out of their village or the Taliban would kill them. They had no security, he says.
Do you miss Afghanistan?
به خاطر هم جنگ نه. اما به خیلی مشکلات هم بچه‌ام به خیلی رویش ضعیف شده بود.
We left because of the war, Aziza tells me. The war left a big psychological scar on my kid. He couldn't sleep at night because he was so scared. He'd say, I think the Taliban are coming to kill us. We all suffered a lot. When Ahmed presses her, "So you don't miss Afghanistan?" She says, "Yes, I do, because it's our country. We love our country. But there's a war and hatred."
We can stop and get, I think that's somebody's hot chocolate.
Very good.
Lovely. Catherine, thank you.
Maysam, did you see people from the Taliban at home?
This is when Maysam tells me the story about the Taliban harassing him when he was out with the sheep. Then his father, Naraga, tells me about the family's decision to leave. I saw a lot of people leave Afghanistan, he says. They left without thinking where they would go. And then I was one of them, just to find a secure place. Naraga starts to tell the story of their harrowing journey, first to Kandahar, then through Taliban areas of Pakistan, then through Iran to Turkey, and a terrifying night crossing to Greece in a boat provided by smugglers, a boat built for 20, crammed with 53 passengers, and an outboard engine that kept breaking down. They made it to a transit camp in Greece, then on through Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia. At one point crossing a border, Naraga got separated from Maysam and Aziza, and they spent a night apart.
And why did they choose Belgium?
When I asked them why they went to Belgium, they laughed. They couldn't really say.
I don't know why.
They'd heard people were friendly and welcoming. It's as if they just got swept along with all the people going that way. After about an hour of these stories, Catherine and Thomas and the kids have to leave. But I stay on for a while, and we continue our conversation outside in the courtyard.
And Maysam, tell me a little bit more about you and your future. What do you hope to do?
I will try a lot to be engineer or doctor, and then of course I have to learn first the language.
Two days later, I get to visit Maysam at his new school, and it's actually full of immigrant kids, about 80%, and there are 500 kids in all, and then there's a special program that does intensive language instruction for newcomers who aren't ready to be in those regular Dutch-speaking classrooms yet. When I visit, there are about 60 kids in that program, and the coordinator is a guy called Christoph van Genechten.
We're a little school in our big school, so the students who come to learn the language, they only study the language a whole week, a whole year. They don't get much other subjects.
En hoe is jouw volledige naam, jouw hele naam?
Izzatullah Jabargel.
Hoe is jouw volledige naam?
Maysam's class just has 6 kids today, all refugees, a couple others from Afghanistan and one each from Syria and Iraq. And when I arrive, they're just starting a new exercise. The only thing they're focused on right now is learning Dutch. Van Genechten says many new arrivals do very well.
And they have quite a good level of education from their homeland, so it goes quite easy to learn a new language. For Maysam, it's a whole different story. He never went to school in Afghanistan, so it's quite difficult to learn a new language when you don't know the system, how to learn a language.
He says it will make a big difference for Maysam that he's here with his parents.
We noticed that on the first day he was here in school, he was already learning. And that's very quick because most of our students, of the refugees, they aren't capable to do that. There is a big difference between accompanied and non-accompanied minors. They don't know what happened with their family. Their family is missing. Their family is maybe dead. They don't know if they can stay in Belgium. They don't know anything. And there are so many uncertainties that they can't start to learn a language because their head is full of misery and sadness.
Hoe oud ben jij?
Ik ben 16 jaar.
Hoe oud ben jij?
13.
Maisem's new teacher is engaging and dynamic, full of encouraging smiles, as she cajoles the kids through a series of exercises, pointing to diagrams on a set of oversized cards.
But it's 14, eh?
There are some funny moments of mistaken meaning in more than one language.
In welke taal spreek jij, Maisem?
Ik spreek daar een beetje Engels en een beetje Nederlands.
A bitch, pas op, hè? Dat is Engels for a bad woman, hè? A bitch. A bitch.
It all looks very promising, seeing these kids who've come from war zones leaning in, answering, valiantly wrapping their tongues around unfamiliar words. When I ask Christoph van Henechten about Maisem's prospects, though, he's sober.
What's the potential for someone starting at 13?
Well, to be honest, it's very difficult. To learn a language, and 13 is already quite old, you need at least 7 years to learn a language quite well. Here in Belgium, they can go to a special school like ours for 1.5, maximum 2 years. And then they need to be ready to go to a regular school. But then you don't go to the high level. So it's gonna be hard. Everybody comes here and wants to be a lawyer or a doctor, but I never met one.
He gets pretty emotional telling me about working in the school, how the teachers become mother and father figures to the kids, how strong the bonds are, how close-knit the team.
Yes, it's very intense. And, oh... Wacht, hè. Ah, dat komt goed.
Break for you.
Yeah. Buslijn naar de Neemkampen staat op met Christoph. Goedemorgen.
The director and other teachers are generous with their time the day I visit. They're intrigued that I'm intrigued by Maisem. There's even a little paranoia at first about an American journalist focusing on an Afghan boy, as if there might be some sort of political motive behind my questions. Van Henechten introduces me to the program's literacy expert, Tina De Bruin, and I see what he means about the intensity of the place. There's a kind of zeal that emanates from her as she begins to describe pretty much everything she knows about the challenge for a kid like Maisem.
Het besef bij individuen en bij kinderen dat het belangrijk zelfs...
They realize quickly that if they want to get anywhere, they have to read and write a language, she says.
En kinderen zoals Maisem, die hebben wij nogal gehad. Dat is niet het eerste geval.
She points out that a case like Maisem is relatively rare. Out of the 40 to 60 kids they have each year, only one or two have no formal education.
Ja, ik wou... Allee, om terug te komen op Maisem.
She explains that the brain of a kid who goes to school when they're little develops differently from someone who starts later. As she explains it, they use parts of their short-term memory differently. If you don't learn how to write your ABCs until you're 13, you actually use a much larger portion of your brain to pull it off. It's automatic in the brains of people who learn it young.
Okay, so does that mean that you have to teach a kid like Maisem differently? Like, if he is illiterate in his own language, can he actually learn a second language before he even knows his first one?
What I'm told is, of course he can, but it will take him a much longer time than if he was already literate in Dari. This is such an interesting area, Patrick, of research, partly because of these huge migrations we're seeing. School districts everywhere are being confronted with this stuff. And a few things were striking to me. As with literate kids, dual language programs, or at least continuing to learn in your first language, seem to be incredibly effective. Basically, you're going to learn quicker and better in the second language if you're further along in your own first language.
Right, and this reflects back on here in the United States, whether you're classified as a ELL, an English language learner, how much of your home language do you speak or are you instructed in alongside English, or as you say, with dual language, where you're learning a certain percentage in each of those two languages.
Yes, and lots of people I spoke to said that is now known to be preferable, and with a kid like Maisem or the equivalent here, you would want to do that as much as possible too, learning to read and write in that first language. But think about it, Patrick, it's not practical, right? And that's why I'm sure the people in Mechelen, in the school where Mysem is, know that too, but they don't have a program to teach him Hindari alongside teaching him Dutch and catching him up in Belgian high school content, right? So
does that mean in his case he's actually not opening books that are written in Hindari and learning how to read or learning how to write in them? He's just doing it in Dutch.
He's just doing it in Dutch. And in fact, if I'm understanding what they're telling me, they're not doing content in the sense of curriculum for his age at all. They're literally trying to get him fluent in Dutch, and then they'll figure out kind of what they need to do about where he's at in his learning. He's clearly incredibly intelligent, but he doesn't have book learning. Which brings me to another point, which is that with non-literate or low-literate kids, they have to decode everything. So we grew up sort of with some automatic stuff that we didn't even realize we learnt about what school is like and what kind of questions we get and what a blackboard is. And all that has to come full on for a 13-year-old who's never been in that environment. So a kid like Mysem has all kinds of knowledge from reading the landscape, from this incredible journey that he had. But he doesn't have school knowledge. He doesn't have school culture knowledge. There are all sorts of things that we know how to do that we don't know how we know how to do because we just went to school regularly. He has to catch up with all of that. And that takes a tremendous effort, apparently, in the brain and just all this acclimatization that goes on.
Well, so again, in Mysem's case, he's exposed to all of this new language learning at just the time when his own body and mind is going through these huge teenage transformations that everyone goes through.
There's another term I learned, adolescent emergent readers, which on the one hand sounds jargony, on the other is sort of quite an elegant phrase. You're just starting to read for the first time in a language different from your native language as an adolescent.
So they can't give him books that they would give a 4 or 5-year-old. An adolescent is not going to be engaged with the sort of kindergarten type learning experience. So what exactly are they teaching?
In this first couple of years at this school, he is only in this special language program. So they are literally trying to get his Dutch as far as they can get it. Maybe this sounds obvious, but you just start with vocabulary. As that literacy expert Tina de Bruin told me, you can't build a house without bricks.
Weinige analfabeten hebben.
She's explaining that Mysem will start to learn vocabulary in his small group, and then as much as possible they will pull him out to begin to teach him the basics of which letters to use for which sounds, so he can work on literacy as well as oral language. And remember, kids who are more literate in their first languages will pick up reading and writing in Dutch much faster. Luckily for Mysem, though, Dutch is easier than some other languages to learn to read and write because there's quite a tight relationship between sounds and letters. You can make spelling mistakes that don't completely change the meaning of the word. And even so, de Bruin says all these kids, literate or not, will need so much drive and desire and discipline to learn Dutch really well. She says it's just too easy to get stuck at a certain level where you have just enough of the language to get by. And to sort of combat that getting stuck place, she tries to just work with each student as an individual and get them as far as she possibly can in the time she has. And so all the way through this conversation with de Bruin, I'm sensing her trying to lower my expectations for what might become of Mysem. So I'm surprised by her answer to this question of mine.
Have you seen kids like Mysem, you know, catch up?
Ja, natuurlijk.
And his dream of becoming a doctor or an engineer?
Let's say that having the dream is of most importance, of biggest importance for, motivating your brain. And then let's say maybe happiness is more realistic and he will become happy in a new dream. And then for me it's okay. It's a really concern for society when the number of people who are frustrated in their own dreams becomes bigger and bigger. That's the part I worry about. But if you ask me, can he become a doctor? I say, yes, he can. Nothing is telling me he will not be able people who talk more realistic say, oh, it will be difficult, and I will fully agree. But I cannot say he cannot. Yeah.
I leave the school feeling pretty inspired. The class seems so warm and intimate. The kids are working their hearts out. The teachers are rooting for them. Later that day, I stop by Catherine's house one more time and ask what her dream is for my Sam.
I think I really want him to have friends here and feel competent in the language, because I think there's a daily, I've worked in other languages, and it's such a daily struggle, and it's such a daily barrier to feeling comfortable when you don't have the language. So I think that's the first thing I would love, is for him to be able to communicate. And I'd love him to figure out through these classes what he's good at, what he's interested in, and, you know, eventually find a job that can sustain him and his parents. I think what I would feel really sad, the scenario, sort of the nightmare scenario for me would be, is if he, there are so many disappointments and setbacks that he gives up and just accepts, you know, that he has to rely on state handouts, because I think it's a recipe for feeling excluded and feeling a failure. I think it's perfectly natural that his parents will have to depend on benefits, because, you know, they're not of the age that they're going to be able to create a new career and really learn the language to the standard they would need. But Maysam could do that, so I would love him to make them proud. We just want him to give it a try and be happy. I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like she can't tell. Nobody knows what the end of this story is going to be.
I tell you though, Patrick, every snippet of news I get from Catherine is so encouraging. One of the best bits was in June. She just out of the blue sent me an email with a little video, and it was Maysam playing hangman with Thomas and the kids. And they had a sheet up on a little clipboard, and they were playing, and you could see him just reveling.
And he was talking Dutch.
And he was talking Dutch.
And Maysam?
There.
Bravo!
A lot of time has gone by since I began reporting this. So the other day, knowing that you and I were going to talk, Catherine and I Skyped just to catch up.
So how are our friends? How's Maysam?
They're good. I mean, firstly, you know, Maysam, you know, continued his school since you left, just loving it and really enthusiastic. I spoke a couple of times with his teacher and the director, and they both said he's so enthusiastic and integrating socially very well. You know, and his Dutch is amazing. I mean, we can now call him and have a proper conversation. You know, it's no longer relying on sign language and so on. We can really chat over the phone in Dutch. And he actually calls us very often just to practice his Dutch, you know, and say hello to the kids. And, you know, he wants to be asked what he did that day.
Yeah.
And the teacher said he's very sociable. He has friends. He's really fond of a couple of these friends.
Wow, that sounds just great. So wait a minute. How long has he been in Belgium now?
They arrived in November 2015, and I visited with them in February, which is also when he switched to that new school. And clearly, between the school and hanging out with Catherine and Thomas and family, his oral Dutch skills are just soaring.
Huh. So even with everything that he's facing, and Belgium is nowhere near as welcoming as it was last year, there have been those terrorist attacks and all of that. Even with that, though, it sounds hopeful for Maysam and his future.
With him in particular, it's so hard not to be completely optimistic. He's an amazing kid. He's getting incredible opportunities. And I think it's just going to be really interesting to see how far he can take it. It's also very hard not to be attached. I mean, I can see how attached Catherine is. And even as a reporter, I so want the best for that kid. And I'll watch the story. I'll stay on it. I'm really grateful to all of them for sort of opening up their lives to me and describing the journey.
Jeb Sharp is a reporter and editor here in Boston at PRI's The World. She took a bunch of photos of my Sam, his family, of Catherine too. They're all at pri.org/language. Also there, we'll post links to some of the research about second language learning for people who can't read or write in their first language. And another link to check out, a New York Times story about a deal that the European Union recently struck with Afghanistan to repatriate tens of thousands of Afghan migrants. Unclear whether this would affect Maysam and his family, but they're still waiting to hear about their asylum application. They're still living in limbo. We're at all the usual places, well, most of them. Facebook, there's a World in Words page, also at Twitter, at LingoPod, and on SoundCloud, and of course, iTunes. Wherever you listen, please leave us a review. It really helps other people find us. Thank you. Nina or I, or both of us, will be back with another pod soon. Very soon, I think. Thanks for listening.
The World in Words is made possible in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence.